Hello and welcome to South Asia Chat, a podcast series brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. I'm Divyani Chaturvedi, research analyst at ISAS, and I will be your host for today's episode. Just as we enter the year 2024, I would like to wish our listeners a very happy new year and season's greetings. We hope this year brings peace and happiness to all. So moving into a new year would be impossible without reflecting on the year that has passed by and discussing what our expectations from 2024 would be. In order to do so, we at ISAS would be releasing a series of podcasts on the strategic outlook of South Asia. Each of these weeks in January will be covering different domains concerning South Asia. So joining us today to discuss the South Asia Outlook 2024 when it comes to foreign policy would be Dr. Yogesh Joshi, Research Fellow at ISAS. Welcome, Dr. Joshi.
Thanks, Divyani. Glad to be here.
The year 2023 has brought about significant geopolitical developments, such as the onset of the Israel-Palestine conflict, continuation of Russia-Ukraine war, and intensification of the Sino-US rivalry, all of which have had a significant impact on the international order and on South Asia. These geopolitical developments are likely to continue to drive foreign policies. Simultaneously, domestic developments such as India's landing on the moon, hosting of the G20, and elections in Bhutan, Bangladesh, and India will influence South Asia's foreign policy outlook this year. So one of my first questions to you would be that a key development in 2023 was India's historic lunar landing and hosting of two major global events, the Group of 20, that is the G20 meeting, and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization's meeting. India to both forums brought a strong agenda and established its global profile to be one of a bridging power and leader of the global south. In 2024, how do you think India would carry this forward?
So it's an interesting question, right? So what has happened in 2023, if one looks analytically, there are three ways to think about India being a global power, right? So for a long period of time, we have been talking about India as a rising power. There are many folks who say that India is also a bridging power, not only in terms of global south and the global north in that sense, but also the existing fault lines between the east and the west, the new fault line, so to say. That is the second conception of India as a major power in international politics. And last, in recent years, what Ashley Tennis would say that India is also a leading power. And what we mean by leading power is that India leads with new issues, new solutions to problems which are being confronted in 21st century. And in some sense, 2023 was a very interesting culmination of all these different avatars of India's power together. In some sense, G20 reflected on that. But there were other markers. One was that India became third largest economy, right? So in terms of rising power, if you calculate latent power, economic power to be a latent power for states, India was kind of catching up and marking its place in terms of rising powers, right? So India's rise has arrived finally. But the G20 also reflected on India's conception as a bridging power. So, you know, the final document for that matter being agreed upon, the consensus document, was in some sense a reflection of India being a bridging power. And India's focus on bringing the global north to support the global south, portraying global south's concerns as the fundamental concerns of international politics today, again, kind of reflected on that bridging component of India's power. And lastly, you know, India is a leading power. So when you look at issues like climate change, issues like technology transfers, issues around tourism or whatever is most concerning, pandemics, supply chains, and all of that, India also kind of showcased the leading component of its rise as a global power. So 2023, in some sense, as I said earlier, has been a very interesting culmination of all these different avatars of India's rise as a major power. And that would mean that, obviously, you know, in a sense that we won't have a G20 again. You know, India is going to pass it on. But we have reached a threshold where India's recognition as all of these components in its powers has been recognized. So that is something which India would like to carry on. But what would be very interesting in this situation is also that many structural factors, and particularly geopolitics, is what India would have to navigate, right? So India has navigated to a large extent the Ukrainian crisis very well. But with the Hamas, Israel attacks, we saw that one of the principal component of the G20 meetings, which was the Israel's, Saudi Arabia, India pipeline, which would automatically connect to Europe, which was a different conception of connectivity in the Europe, Middle East, Western Indian Ocean, has become a casualty, right? So structural changes and structural volatility in the current international politics would be a major issue for India. So would be a confrontation over Taiwan. So I think much more than anything else, it is the structural volatility in international politics, which India would have to take care of. In so far as domestic politics is concerned, it appears that there would be significant continuity as far as whatever is projected in terms of next government, right? So if that continues with Modi's emphasis on India's rise, making India $5 trillion economy and all of that, there appears to be a lot of domestic stability. So, there's not a lot of domestic churn one would anticipate. And economically too, it appears that India has gained and recovered after the COVID-19 crisis. It is still kind of developing at a 6-7% rate, not as much as India would like to, but it is the fastest growing economy in the world. So in some sense, the macro indicators for India appear to be pretty stable, except the structural fault lines, which would create some obstacles for India, and that is what diplomacy is for. As far as the larger South Asia is concerned, we are looking at, when you look at the western borders, western frontiers around India, Afghanistan and Pakistan, we would see that both domestic instability would continue, but also the rise of insurgencies and terrorism and proxy wars that would leave the AFPAC geography still very, afflicted by those concerns. So I'm not very sure whether a lot would change in terms of those fault lines. The other issue which I would highlight in terms of the larger South Asia region is domestic change in smaller South Asian countries. And that is what we see with Maldives recently, right? So if a new political dispensation comes, which kind of seeks new great power friends, you would see some foreign policy consternation again in South Asia. And what has happened in South Asia and almost all economies which are in some sense dependent upon foreign aid is some kind of polarization between China on one hand and anti-China forces on the other, which is not only India but also the US and the West. And that is what is happening, as we see, has happened with Sri Lanka earlier, happened in Maldives earlier, that too the case in Pakistan as well. So internal domestic changes would create complications for smaller South Asian countries and how they relate to the larger geopolitics in the region.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for giving us a very interesting landscape of what South Asia and India would look like in 2024. I think taking that thought forward and looking further into India and South Asia relations, one of the greatest feat for India this year was its historic lunar landing. What that did was that it opened more avenues for space cooperation, and we see that there is greater strengthening of relations between India and the West, and especially the US on accord of that. However, what it also does is it creates greater power asymmetries between India and South Asian countries that are its neighbors. So in context of that, I think how do you see this impacting India's relations with its immediate neighborhood, especially in the context of the China-India competition that is going on within the region?
Right. So, the lunar landing, there's a technological component to it, which is in some sense an apogee of 21st century technological progress. You know, it's in some sense a Sputnik moment for India, just as it was for Russia at some point in time. And so in terms of just the prestige associated with that also, but also largely the technological part, you know, it definitely was a great achievement for India. But that I think reflects something deeper in Indian society. It reflects a very aspirational India, right? It also reflects greater dynamism, but fundamentally it reflects perseverance in Indian society, right? So this is not the first time. This was the third attempt for India to kind of do that lunar landing, and also the ambition. So I think there are greater sociological meanings to what kind of power India would be, rather than just the technological feat, which the lunar landing kind of symbolizes, right? And that is what, I would say is the Indian foreign policy today. You know, stamping its role, its influence all over the world, and doing it without any remorse. Whether it was the Ukrainian crisis, whether it was taking for the first time a stance on the Taiwan issue for that matter, or unequivocally supporting Israel after the October 7 attacks, right? So there are very clear-cut patterns and very decisive patterns which can be discerned in Indian foreign policy today, as was not the case before. And this has been in the making. And this is not just, you know, the leadership is one of the factors, but this is also because India is far more capable today to take those positions, right? India is far more important for other actors today to tolerate India's position. So it's much more structural as well, but there's definitely an element of leadership styles, but also the domestic stability, right? So even if leave aside the leader, if there would have been a coalition of political parties governing India at this point in time, the response might have been different. So there are a number of factors which are coming together, but largely I would say that it is just India's capacity and capability at this point in time, and it's just growing importance given how the world is tagged right now, that is giving India that force to influence things around not only in its neighborhood, but also, but also globally. But that doesn't mean that, that India isn't getting influenced itself, right? It's a two-way street in some sense. When it comes to the US for that matter, India needs US as much as US needs India. So that is not lost on Indian decision makers, so to say. There is definitely a need for some kind of accommodation with China, but it is not as if India would accommodate from a position of weakness. So I think there are far more in an analysis of Indian foreign policy need to be far more nuanced, rather than just frame it either in terms of Indian tribalism, where everything is hunky and dory. On the other hand, an external appreciation of India being just a result of, a particular kind of nationalistic government, right? So I think there are multiple factors, and that nuance needs to be appreciated. Having said so, the larger question of India and China, right? So when we look at the India-China at this point in time, the relations are in deep freeze. And we haven't seen any kind of movement on, first of all, on the border issue. So as I said earlier, right, India would want to accommodate China, want an accommodation with China. But the question for India has always been at what cost, right? So if India could raise the cost enough for China that it can reach a reasonable accommodation, and that's what India is trying to do, with whether it is militarily balancing China internally or using its diplomatic connections to beef up its external capability to do so. But In my understanding of India-China relations, it is not as if India doesn't want an accommodation with China. It does want to have an accommodation with China. The question is what kind of accommodation. But until and unless India reaches a stage where it can reach a respectful accommodation, you would see that these relations will continue to remain in a deep freeze, as is the case with the border issue, but diplomatically as well, whether it was the BRICS summit in South Africa or the G20 where President Xi Jinping didn't really come. So that diplomatic freeze will continue and that shadow boxing over the region. So one thing which is very interesting over here is that India might want a multipolar world, but it doesn't want a bipolar Asia, right? So that dynamics is firmly entrenched in India's mind. As far as India and Pakistan are concerned, I think the current strategy of isolating Pakistan would continue, and to increase that asymmetry between India and Pakistan, whether it is economic, military wise, that relationship has, in some sense, what the Indian government, at least for the last 10 years, is trying to do is to make Pakistan irrelevant for India, and has succeeded for, you know, for succeeded in some measures quite well. So whatever may be the questions from Pakistan, 370 is not going back. Kashmir will continue to remain. You know, the Kashmir issue, at least on the Indian side, has been resolved. And lastly, about the smaller South Asian states, I would again repeat the point which I emphasized earlier. A lot of how India deals with, or smaller South Asian states deal with India, is now related to the internal political dimensions and internal political churn within these countries. There are clear divisions in terms of political class affiliating with great powers, either on this side or that side. And sometimes those things are beyond what India can control. And the recent example of Maldives is a classic example, where now the new government is basically asking India to remove its military, aid packages and assistance packages and all of that. So, and clearly identifying itself to be more closer to China. So there are certain things which you can't really control.
Right. I think the previous year has witnessed concerted efforts by China and Russia, especially, to engage deeply with South Asia and pose a challenge to the US-led and India-driven developments in the Indo-Pacific, while also countering some notions of the liberal international order. How do you think South Asia so far has responded to these efforts? What do you think is motivating these efforts by the Sino-Russian axis?
Right. So it, you know, so one needs to kind of disaggregate how states are responding to one of these major fault lines, right? So China and Russia constitute the Eurasian landmass, right? And that is significant for all actors in South Asia who are, in some sense, fundamentally attached to the Eurasian landmass. Even when they might have a maritime outlook, right? Just as India, for that matter. So South Asia, in that sense, is a very fragile underbelly of Eurasia. So in that geographic sense, needs to be appreciated before we move on to answer that question. Now, what happens since you are connected to the larger Eurasian landmass, you cannot really ignore what Russia and China, or this Eurasian axis of authoritarians, if one would want to say, is trying to do, which is to create new allies, create a new conception of international order, and in some sense, give fillip to multipolarity to the extent that it challenges the US and the larger West. Not only materially, but also normatively. Now, what when these kind of fault lines do occur in international politics, states can either deal with these kind of fault lines if they have the capacity to do so, such as India, which has to a large extent dealt with, whether it was the Ukraine crisis or whether it is, its own relations with China, has had the capacity to deal with them upfront. Or if you can maneuver to hide, right? Where none of these, where you try to position yourself in a way that you are not caught in the middle of these great powers. And now, most of South Asian states would try to hide from the US-China competition, try to gain from India-China competition, of course, but try to hide away from the US-China competition. And then there are states like Pakistan who neither have the capability nor can hide, right? Because they are right at the fulcrum of this significant fault line. So, it depends upon state to state in a sense. In case of India, it has a great amount of capability to, of course, there would be cost to pay. But as far as Indian diplomacy is concerned, when you look at whether purchasing oil from Russia, or for that matter, the continued military purchases from Russia, India has not backed down. But it's also a factor of India's importance in US Indo-Pacific strategy. Not only India's capacity, but as I earlier said, India's importance in the current geopolitics. Whereas Pakistan, when you look at that, is now talking about non-alignment, right? So in South Asia, people who used to talk about non-alignment don't talk about them anymore. And states which always sided with one power or the other are not talking about non-alignment, right? So it's just the times. Times are always strange. Just because, Pakistan neither has the capability nor can it hide from the fault lines of the great power dynamics at this stage. So that's what I would say, in a sense that, and most of these small states, again, this is not just US China, it's also a number of other major powers in the region, whether it is India, Japan, Australia. They would like to position themselves in a way that they can maximize what they can get out of this confrontation. But the problem with all small states is that that if these fault lines or these fault lines become confrontatious, then they have to choose one way or the other. And that also creates a lot of domestic instability, whether you look at Nepal or Sri Lanka for that matter. So we are looking at a number of small South Asian states going through a period of significant domestic instability arising out of how the great power politics influence their domestic politics, as well as how their domestic politics is responding to this the incentives and disincentives of this great power dynamics.
Absolutely. I think no conversation on South Asia is complete without China and Russia, but also about the US. So I think in the last few years, especially, we see that India and the US, their relationship has strengthened, and a large part of US engagement with South Asia has also been via India. However, something interesting that has come up this year was that we witnessed the US adopt coercive measures towards Bangladesh in their visa policies on the premise of Bangladesh holding unfair elections. This emphasis on accountability and democracy deficit is not uncommon in the region. We see Pakistan and India both lying low in democratic practices. However, Bangladesh has been the only state at the receiving end of these coercive measures. How do you view this? And what, according to you, are key drivers of South Asia's engagement with the US and the West?
So first of all, as far as democracy deficit is concerned, in the sense that all South Asian states and most of the states world over would be democratically, facing a deficit. Leave aside that part of it. But in a sense that when look at Bangladesh, what is happening here is that Bangladesh is not central to the geopolitics of the Indo-Pacific for the U.S. But if the Biden administration coming from the Democrats as they do, have to give and provide an example of where they are pursuing their agenda on democracy deficits, can easily be Bangladesh. So in a sense that Bangladesh is structurally not in a great position, as is the case with India, which has a huge amount of capability, or in Pakistan for that matter. They tried to do it in Pakistan initially with the Imran Khan government and all of that, but Pakistan still is better placed compared to Bangladesh. Not to say that there is no democratic deficit in Bangladesh, and the Khalida Zia government and all of that are not are great Democrats, so to say. But it's also that Bangladesh in the larger Indo-Pacific strategy doesn't really fit in terms of doesn't really fit as a major component of US in US interest. Just compare that with how US is responding to Vietnam, which is a communist government in any case, right? So there are no in a sense that it's very difficult to judge what's US policy on Bangladesh, is whether it is just coming from a high moral ground, or it is part of the Biden administration's agenda on democracy, which can only be selectively imposed on a few countries. And Bangladesh appears to be sadly to be, a good target in that sense.
Absolutely. I think when we look at counterbalancing China as well in South Asia, some of the key powers that have emerged in the recent years are actually the middle powers, which would be Japan and Australia. And we saw the resurrection of Quad 2.0 and new people coming in. In the forthcoming year, how do you think what role would these middle powers play in the region, and what impact are they likely to have?
So the middle powers are going to be extremely interesting, especially the Japan part of it, and in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia. So these are two middle powers, which I would say India should be keenly looking at, or maybe the whole of South Asia should be keenly looking at, as part of the US-led security architecture. Japan is now becoming a major node for all activities which would focus in some sense of containing China's military rise in Northeast Asia. And Japan would be central to any activity, military activity in Taiwan, and confronting any the use of force, military force, vis-a-vis Taiwan. So that one is clear. But on the other hand, even Japan, with the kind of revocations they are doing on their constitution, the militarization of Japan, and Japan's newfound enthusiasm for greater military action abroad, we are looking at, and especially with the kind of threat China is posing in Northeast Asia, we are looking at somewhere, not just a middle power, but revival of Japan as a major military power in Asia. And that, as an independent factor, is significant for India. So that is one thing. The other thing is the amount of economic resources Japan has to counter China's economic influence in the region, whether it is the ODA, official development assistance, or working with like-minded partners such as the EU or Southeast Asian countries or India, over connectivity and technology too. So, across all spectrums of engagement, I think Japan is far is and see and not because Japan wants to, but because it is feeling that pressure to kind of respond to China's rise, that it might become increasingly independent of US influence and emerge as a truly independent middle power in Asia. So that is one thing India would be clearly looking at, and the whole of South Asia would be looking at. The second is Saudi Arabia, which is again trying to come out of the coattails of the US, looking at diversifying its economy from just being a petroleum-rich state to being, of technologically transforming itself for the future, also putting itself right, hedging with China as well as Russia, having an independent foreign policy, and revising some of its traditionally held strategic assumptions, whether it was in Pakistan for that matter, but just the closeness and the personal chemistry between the leadership in India and Saudi Arabia. So I think Saudi Arabia's rise as an independent middle actor in Middle East is again a significant opportunity for India and would change to a significant extent the geopolitics of the Middle East, but also the Western Indian Ocean. So those are the two major middle powers I think would be very, very consequential for India and South Asia.
Thank you so much. I think Japan has historically also played a great role in South Asia when it comes to developmental aid. But I have a small question regarding Saudi Arabia, which is that given the current crisis that's going on in the Middle East, do you think that crisis has the ability to eclipse Saudi Arabia's role in South Asia? If so, how would you think so?
No, what the current crisis has done has foiled the American plans to normalize Israel in the Middle East. But I don't think that the crisis fundamentally changes the Saudi Arabian necessity to reposition itself, both in regional politics as well as global politics. In fact, Riyadh would feel to be as much constrained by Hamas's actions, and maybe, in all likelihood, Hamas's actions were particularly targeted at not at what Israel does in Gaza, but what Israel could have done with Saudi Arabia, right? So there are different audiences here. There are different signals, and therefore, maybe that normalization process it has now capitulated, but that doesn't mean that Saudi Arabia, as an increasingly important autonomous actor, rise of Saudi Arabia as an increasingly independent autonomous actor is now under some kind of a cloud. I think the crisis itself would be a major point, would only highlight the requirements of Saudi Arabia to become a more prominent actor in the region.
Great. Thank you so much for your time and for giving us insight into what South Asia strategic outlook for 2024 may look like. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
You were listening to South Asia Chat. To learn more about our work, please visit us at isas.nus.edu.sg. You can also get updates from our social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Twitter.